If I were Moira, I'd know how to take it apart, reduce it to its cutting edges. I have no screwdriver, but if I were Moira, I could do it without a screwdriver. I'm not Moira. What would she tell me about the commander if she were here? Probably she'd disapprove. She disapproved of Luke back then. Not of Luke, but of the fact that he was married. She said I was poaching on another woman's ground. I said Luke wasn't a fish or a piece of dirt either. He was a human being and could make his own decisions. She said I was rationalizing. I said I was in love. She said that was no excuse. Moira was always more logical than I am. I said she didn't have that problem herself anymore, since she'd decided to prefer women, and as far as I could see, she had no scruples about stealing them or borrowing them when she felt like it. She said it was different, because the balance of power was equal between women, so sex was an even-Steven transaction. I said even-Steven was a sexist phrase if she was going to be like that, and anyway, that argument was outdated. She said I had trivialized the issue, and if I thought it was outdated, I was living with my head in the sand. We said all this in my kitchen, drinking coffee, sitting at my kitchen table in those low, intense voices we used for such arguments when we were in our early 20s, a carryover from college. The kitchen was in a rundown apartment in a clapboard house near the river, the kind with three stories and a rickety outside back staircase. I had the second floor, which meant I got noise from both above and below, two unwanted disc players thumping late into the night. Students I knew. I was still on my first job, which didn't pay much. I worked a computer in an insurance company. So the hotels, with Luke, didn't mean only love or even only sex to me. They also meant time off from the cockroaches, the dripping sink, the linoleum that was peeling off the floor in patches, even from my own attempts to brighten things up by sticking posters on the wall and hanging prisms in the windows. I had plants, too, though they always got spider mites or died from being unwatered. I would go off with Luke and neglect them. I said there was more than one way of living with your head in the sand, and that if Moira thought she could create utopia by shutting herself up in a women-only enclave, she was sadly mistaken. Men were not just going to go away, I said. You couldn't just ignore them. That's like saying you should go out and catch syphilis merely because it exists, Moira said. Are you calling Luke a social disease, I said. Moira laughed. Listen to us, she said. Shit, we sound like your mother. We both laughed then, and when she left, we hugged each other as usual. There was a time when we didn't hug, after she told me about being gay. But then she said I didn't turn her on, reassuring me, and we'd gone back to it. We could fight and wrangle and name-call, but it didn't change anything underneath. She was still my oldest friend. Is. I got a better apartment after that, where I lived for the 2 years it took Luke to pry himself loose. I paid for it myself, with my new job. It was in a library, not the big one with Death and Victory, a smaller one. I worked transferring books to computer disks to cut down on storage space and replacement costs, they said. Diskers, we called ourselves. We called the library a discotheque, which was a joke of ours. After the books were transferred, they were supposed to go to the shredder, but sometimes I took them home with me. I liked the feel of them and the look. Luke said I had the mind of an antiquarian. He liked that. He liked old things himself. It's strange now to think about having a job. Job. It's a funny word. It's a job for a man. Do a jobby, they'd say to children when they were being toilet trained. Or of dogs. He did a job on the carpet. You were supposed to hit them with rolled up newspapers, my mother said. I can remember when there were newspapers, though I never had a dog, only cats. The Book of Job. All those women having jobs. Hard to imagine now, but thousands of them had jobs, millions. It was considered the normal thing. Now it's like remembering the paper money when they still had that, My mother kept some of it, pasted into her scrapbook along with the early photos. It was obsolete by then. You couldn't buy anything with it. Pieces of paper, thickish, greasy to the touch, green-colored, with pictures on each side, some old man in a wig, and on the other side a pyramid with an eye above it. It said, "In God we trust." My mother said people used to have signs beside their cash registers for a joke. "In God we trust. All others pay cash." That would be blasphemy now. You had to take those pieces of paper with you when you went shopping, though by the time I was 9 or 10, most people used plastic cards. Not for the groceries, though. That came later. It seemed so primitive. Totemistic, even. Like cowrie shells. I must have used that kind of money myself a little before everything went on the CompuBank. I guess that's how they were able to do it, in the way they did, all at once, without anyone knowing beforehand. If there had still been portable money, it would have been more difficult. It was after the catastrophe, when they shot the president and machine-gunned the Congress and the army declared a state of emergency. They blamed it on the Islamic fanatics at the time. "Keep calm," they said on television. "Everything is under control." I was stunned. Everyone was, I know that. It was hard to believe. The entire government gone like that. How did they get in? How did it happen? That was when they suspended the Constitution. They said it would be temporary. There wasn't even any rioting in the streets. People stayed home at night, watching television, looking for some direction. There wasn't even an enemy you could put your finger on. "Look out," said Moira to me over the phone. "Here it comes." "Hear what comes?" I said. "You wait," she said. "They've been building up to this. It's you and me up against the wall, baby." She was quoting an expression of my mother's, but she wasn't intending to be funny. Things continued in that state of suspended animation for weeks, although some things did happen. Newspapers were censored and some were closed down for security reasons, they said. The roadblocks began to appear, and identipasses. Everyone approved of that, since it was obvious you couldn't be too careful. They said that new elections would be held, but that it would take some time to prepare for them. The thing to do, they said, was to continue on as usual. The porno marts were shut, though, and there were no longer any Feels on Wheels vans and bundle buggies circling the square. But I wasn't sad to see them go. We all knew what a nuisance they'd been. "It's high time somebody did something," said the woman behind the counter at the store where I usually bought my cigarettes. It was on the corner, a newsstand chain, papers, candy, cigarettes. The woman was older, with gray hair, my mother's generation. "Did they just close them, or what?" I asked. She shrugged. "Who knows? Who cares?" she said. "Maybe they just moved them off somewhere else. Trying to get rid of it altogether is like trying to stamp out mice, you know?" She punched my compu number into the till, barely looking at it. I was a regular by then. "People were complaining," she said. The next morning, on my way to the library for the day, I stopped by the same store for another pack because I'd run out. I was smoking more those days. It was the tension. You could feel it, like a subterranean hum, although things seemed so quiet. I was drinking more coffee, too, and having trouble sleeping. Everyone was a little jumpy. There was a lot more music on the radio than usual, and fewer words. It was after we'd been married for years, it seemed. She was 3 or 4, and daycare. We'd all got up in the usual way and had breakfast, granola, I remember, and Luke had driven her off to school in a little outfit I'd bought her just a couple of weeks before, striped overalls and a blue T-shirt. What month was this? It must have been September. There was a school pool that was supposed to pick them up, but for some reason I wanted Luke to do it. I was getting worried, even about the school pool. No children walked to school anymore. There had been too many disappearances. When I got to the corner store, the usual woman wasn't there. Instead, there was a man, A young man, he couldn't have been more than 20. "She's sick?" I said as I handed him my card. "Who?" he said, aggressively, I thought. "The woman who's usually here," I said. "How would I know?" he said. He was punching my number in, studying each number, punching with one finger. He obviously hadn't done it before. I drummed my fingers on the counter, impatient for a cigarette, wondering if anyone had ever told him something could be done about those pimples on his neck. I remember quite clearly what he looked like. Tall, slightly stooped, dark hair cut short, brown eyes that seemed to focus 2 inches behind the bridge of my nose and that acne. I suppose I remember him so clearly because of what he said next. "Sorry," he said. "This number's not valid." "That's ridiculous," I said. "It must be. I've got thousands in my account. I just got the statement 2 days ago. Try it again." "It's not valid," he repeated obstinately. "See that red light? Means it's not valid." "You must have made a mistake," I said. "Try it again." He shrugged and gave me a fed-up smile, but he did try the number again. This time I watched his fingers on each number and checked the numbers that came up in the window. It was my number, all right, but there was the red light again. "See?" he said again, still with that smile, as if he knew some private joke he wasn't going to tell me. "I'll phone them from the office," I said. The system had fouled up before, but a few phone calls usually straightened it out. Still, I was angry, as if I'd been unjustly accused of something I didn't even know about. As if I'd made the mistake myself. "You do that," he said, indifferently. I left the cigarettes on the counter since I hadn't paid for them. I figured I could borrow some at work. I did phone from the office, but all I got was a recording. The lines were overloaded, the recording said. Could I please phone back? The line stayed overloaded all morning, as far as I could tell. I phoned back several times, but no luck. Even that wasn't too unusual. About 2 o'clock, after lunch, the director came into the disking room. "I have something to tell you," he said. He looked terrible. His hair was untidy. His eyes were pink and wobbling, as though he'd been drinking. We all looked up, turned off our machines. There must have been 8 or 10 of us in the room. "I'm sorry," he said, "but it's the law. I really am sorry."
"For what?" somebody said.
"I have to let you go," he said. "It's the law. I have to. I have to let you all go." He said this almost gently, as if we were wild animals, frogs he'd caught in a jar, as if he were being humane.
"We're being fired?" I said. I stood up, "but why?"
"Not fired," he said. "Let go. You can't work here anymore. It's the law." He ran his hands through his hair, and I thought, he's gone crazy. The strain has been too much for him, and he's blown his wiring.
"You can't just do that," said the woman who sat next to me. This sounded false, improbable, like something he would say on television.
It isn't me," he said.
"You don't understand. Please go, now." His voice was rising. "I don't want any trouble. If there's trouble, the books might be lost. Things will get broken." He looked over his shoulder.
"They're outside," he said, "in my office. If you don't go now, they'll come in themselves. They gave me 10 minutes. By now, he sounded crazier than ever.
"He's loopy," someone said out loud, which we must all have thought.
But I could see out into the corridor, and there were 2 men standing there in uniforms with machine guns. This was too theatrical to be true, yet there they were, sudden apparitions, like Martians. There was a dreamlike quality to them. They were too vivid, too at odds with their surroundings.
"Just leave the machines," he said, while we were getting our things together, filing out, as if we could have taken them.
We stood in a cluster on the steps outside the library. We didn't know what to say to one another.
Since none of us understood what had happened, there was nothing much we could say. We looked at one another's faces and saw dismay and a certain shame, as if we'd been caught doing something we shouldn't.
"It's outrageous," one woman said, but without belief.
What was it about this that made us feel we deserved it? When I got back to the house, nobody was there. Luke was still at work. My daughter was at school. I felt tired, bone tired. But when I sat down, I got up again. I couldn't seem to sit still. I wandered through the house from room to room. I remember touching things, not even that consciously, just placing my fingers on them. Things like the toaster, the sugar bowl, the ashtray in the living room. After a while, I picked up the cat and carried her around with me. I wanted Luke to come home. I thought I should do something, take steps, but I didn't know what steps I could take. I tried phoning the bank again, but I only got the same recording. I poured myself a glass of milk. I told myself I was too jittery for another coffee, and went into the living room and sat down on the sofa and put the glass of milk on the coffee table, carefully, without drinking any of it. I held the cat up against my chest so I could feel her purring against my throat. After a while, I phoned my mother at her apartment, but there was no answer. She'd settled down more by then. She'd stopped moving every few years. She lived across the river, in Boston. I waited a while and phoned Moira. She wasn't there either, but when I tried half an hour later, she was. In between these phone calls, I just sat on the sofa. What I thought about was my daughter's school lunches. I thought maybe I'd been giving her too many peanut butter sandwiches. "I've been fired," I told Moira when I got her on the phone. She said she would come over. By that time, she was working for a women's collective, the publishing division. They put out books on birth control and rape and things like that, though there wasn't as much demand for those things as there used to be. "I'll come over," she said. She must have been able to tell from my voice this is what I wanted. She got there after some time. "So," she said. She threw off her jacket, sprawled into the oversized chair. "Tell me. First we'll have a drink." She got up and went to the kitchen and poured us a couple of scotches and came back and sat down, and I tried to tell her what had happened to me. When I'd finished, she said, "Tried getting anything on your CompuCard today?" "Yes," I said. I told her about that, too. "They've frozen them," she said. "Mine, too. The collective's, too. Any account with an F on it instead of an M. All they need to do is push a few buttons. We're cut off." "But I've got over $2,000 in the bank," I said, as if my own account was the only one that mattered. "Women can't hold property anymore," she said. "It's a new law." "Turned on the TV today?" "No," I said. "It's on there," she said. "All over the place." She was not stunned the way I was. In some strange way, she was gleeful, as if this was what she'd been expecting for some time, and now she'd been proven right. She even looked more energetic, more determined. "Luke can use your CompuCount for you," she said. "They'll transfer your number to him, or that's what they say. Husband or male next of kin." "But what about you?" I said. She didn't have anyone. "I'll go underground," she said. "Some of the gays can take over our numbers and buy us things we need." "But why?" I said. "Why did they?" "Ours is not to reason why," said Moira. "They had to do it that way, the CompuCounts and the jobs both at once. Can you picture the airports otherwise? They don't want us going anywhere, you can bet on that." I went to pick my daughter up from school. I drove with exaggerated care. By the time Luke got home, I was sitting at the kitchen table. She was drawing with felt pens at her own little table in the corner, where her paintings were taped up next to the refrigerator. Luke knelt beside me and put his arms around me. "I heard," he said, on the car radio driving home. "Don't worry, I'm sure it's temporary." "Did they say why?" I said. He didn't answer that. "We'll get through it," he said, hugging me. "You don't know what it's like," I said. I feel as if somebody cut off my feet. I wasn't crying. Also, I couldn't put my arms around him. "It's only a job," he said, trying to soothe me. "I guess you get all my money," I said. "And I'm not even dead." I was trying for a joke, but it came out sounding macabre. "Hush," he said. He was still kneeling on the floor. "You know I'll always take care of you." I thought, already he's starting to patronize me. Then I thought, already you're starting to get paranoid. "I know," I said. "I love you." Later, after she was in bed and we were having supper, and I wasn't feeling so shaky, I told him about the afternoon. I described the director coming in, blurting out his announcement. "It would have been funny if it wasn't so awful," I said. "I thought he was drunk." Maybe he was. The army was there and everything. Then I remembered something I'd seen and hadn't noticed at the time. It wasn't the army. It was some other army. There were marches, of course, a lot of women and some men, but they were smaller than you might have thought. I guess people were scared. And when it was known that the police or the army or whoever they were would open fire almost as soon as any of the marches even started, the marches stopped. A few things were blown up, post offices, subway stations, but you couldn't even be sure who was doing it. It could have been the army, to justify the computer searches and the other ones, the door-to-doors. I didn't go on any of the marches. Luke said it would be futile, and I had to think about them, my family, him and her. I did think about my family. I started doing more housework, more baking. I tried not to cry at mealtimes. By this time I'd started to cry, without warning, and to sit beside the bedroom window, staring out. I didn't know many of the neighbors, and when we met, outside on the street, we were careful to exchange nothing more than the ordinary greetings. Nobody wanted to be reported for disloyalty. Remembering this, I remember also my mother years before. I must have been 14, 15, that age when daughters are most embarrassed by their mothers. I remember her coming back to one of our many apartments with a group of other women, part of her ever-changing circle of friends. They'd been in a march that day. It was during the time of the porn riots, or was it the abortion riots? They were close together. There were a lot of bombings then. Clinics, video stores. It was hard to keep track. My mother had a bruise on her face and a little blood. "You can't stick your hand through a glass window without getting cut," is what she said about it. "Fucking pigs." "Fucking bleeders," one of her friends said. They called the other side bleeders, after the signs they carried. "Let them bleed." So it must have been the abortion riots. I went into my bedroom, to be out of their way. They were talking too much and too loudly. They ignored me, and I resented them. My mother and her rowdy friends. I didn't see why she had to dress that way, in overalls, as if she were young, or to swear so much. "You're such a prude," she would say to me, in a tone of voice that was on the whole pleased. She liked being more outrageous than I was, more rebellious. Adolescents are always such prudes. Part of my disapproval was that, I'm sure. Perfunctory, routine. But also I wanted from her a life more ceremonious, less subject to makeshift and decampment. "You are a wanted child, God knows," she would say at other moments, lingering over the photo albums in which she had me framed. These albums were thick with babies, but my replicas thinned out as I grew older, as if the population of my duplicates had been hit by some plague. She would say this a little regretfully, as though I hadn't turned out entirely as she'd expected. No mother is ever completely a child's idea of what a mother should be, and I suppose it works the other way around as well. But despite everything, we didn't do badly by one another. We did as well as most. I wish she were here, so I could tell her I finally know this. Someone has come out of the house.
I hear the distant closing of a door, around at the side, footsteps on the walk. It's Nick. I can see him now. He stepped off the path onto the lawn to breathe in the humid air which stinks of flowers, of pulpy growth, of pollen thrown into the wind in handfuls, like oyster spawn into the sea. All this prodigal breeding. He stretches in the sun. I feel the ripple of muscles go along him, like a cat's back arching. He's in his shirt sleeves, bare arms sticking shamelessly out from the rolled cloth. Where does the tan end? I haven't spoken to him since that one night, dreamscape in the moon-filled sitting room. He's only my flag, my semaphore, body language. Right now, his cap's on sideways. Therefore, I am sent for. What does he get for it, his role as page boy? How does he feel, pimping in this ambiguous way for the commander? Does it fill him with disgust, or make him want more of me? Want me more? Because he has no idea what really goes on in there, among the books. Acts of perversion, for all he knows. The commander and me, covering each other with ink, licking it off, or making love on stacks of forbidden newsprint. Well, he wouldn't be far off at that. But depend on it, there's something in it for him. Everyone's on the take, one way or another. Extra cigarettes? Extra freedoms not allowed to the general run? Anyway, what can he prove? It's his word against the commander's, unless he wants to head a posse. Kick in the door, and what did I tell you? Caught in the act, sinfully scrabbling. Quick, eat those words. Maybe he just likes the satisfaction of knowing something secret, of having something on me, as they used to say. It's the kind of power you can use only once. I would like to think better of him. That night, after I'd lost my job, Luke wanted to make love. Why didn't I want to? Desperation alone should have driven me, but I still felt numbed. I could hardly even feel his hands on me. "What's the matter?" he said. "I don't know," I said. "We still have," he said. But he didn't go on to say what we still had. It occurred to me that he shouldn't be saying "we," since nothing that I knew of had been taken away from him. "We still have each other," I said. It was true. Then why did I sound, even to myself, so indifferent? He kissed me then, as if now I'd said that things could get back to normal. But something had shifted, some balance. I felt shrunken, so that when he put his arms around me, gathering me up, I was small as a doll. I felt love going forward without me. "He doesn't mind this," I thought. "He doesn't mind it at all. Maybe he even likes it. We're not each other's anymore. Instead, I am his." Unworthy, unjust, untrue. But that is what happened. "So, Luke, what I want to ask you now, what I need to know is, was I right? Because we never talked about it. By the time I could have done that, I was afraid to. I couldn't afford to lose you." Chapter 29. I'm sitting in the commander's office, across from him at his desk, in the client position, as if I'm a bank customer negotiating a hefty loan. But apart from my placement in the room, little of that formality remains between us. I no longer sit stiff-necked, straight-backed, feet regimented side by side on the floor, eyes at the salute. Instead, my body's lax, cozy even. My red shoes are off, my legs tucked up underneath me on the chair, surrounded by a buttress of red skirt, true, but tucked nonetheless, as at a campfire of earlier and more picnic days. If there were a fire in the fireplace, its light would be twinkling on the polished surfaces, glimmering warmly on flesh. I add the firelight in. As for the commander, he's casual to a fault tonight. Jacket off, elbows on the table. All he needs is a toothpick in the corner of his mouth to be an ad for rural democracy, as in an etching. Fly-specked. Some old burned book. The squares on the board in front of me are filling up. I'm making my penultimate play of the night. Zilch, I spell. A convenient one-vowel word with an expensive Z. Is that a word? Says the commander. We could look it up, I say. It's archaic. I'll give it to you, he says. He smiles. The commander likes it when I distinguish myself. Show precocity, like an attentive pet. Prick-eared and eager to perform. His approbation laps me like a warm bath. I sense in him none of the animosity I used to sense in men, even in Luke sometimes. He's not saying bitch in his head. In fact, he is positively daddy-ish. He likes to think I am being entertained, and I am. I am. Deftly, he adds up our final scores on his pocket computer. You ran away with it, he says. I suspect him of cheating, to flatter me, to put me in a good mood. But why? It remains a question. What does he have to gain from this sort of pampering? There must be something. He leans back, fingertips together, a gesture familiar to me now. We have built up a repertoire of such gestures, such familiarities between us. He's looking at me, not unbenevolently, but with curiosity, as if I'm a puzzle to be solved. What would you like to read tonight? He says. This, too, has become routine. So far, I've been through a Mademoiselle magazine, an old Esquire from the 80s, a Ms., a magazine I can remember vaguely as having been around my mother's various apartments while I was growing up, and a Reader's Digest. He even has novels. I've read a Raymond Chandler, and right now I'm halfway through Hard Times by Charles Dickens. On these occasions, I read quickly, voraciously, almost skimming, trying to get as much into my head as possible before the next long starvation. If it were eating, it would be the gluttony of the famished. If it were sex, it would be a swift, furtive stand-up in an alley somewhere. While I read, the commander sits and watches me doing it, without speaking, but also without taking his eyes off me. This watching is a curiously sexual act, and I feel undressed while he does it. I wish he would turn his back, stroll around the room, read something himself. Then perhaps I could relax more, take my time. As it is, this illicit reading of mine seems a kind of performance. I think I'd rather just talk, I say. I'm surprised to hear myself saying it. He smiles again. He doesn't appear surprised. Possibly he's been expecting this, or something like it. Oh, he says. What would you like to talk about? I falter. Anything, I guess. Well, you, for instance. Me? He continues to smile. Oh, there's not much to say about me. I'm just an ordinary kind of guy. The falsity of this, and even the falsity of the diction, guy, pulls me up short. Ordinary guys do not become commanders. You must be good at something, I say. I know I'm prompting him, playing up to him, drawing him out, and I dislike myself for it. It's nauseating, in fact. But we are fencing. Either he talks or I will. I know it. I can feel speech backing up inside me. It's so long since I've really talked with anyone. The terse, whispered exchange with Ofglen on our walk today hardly counts. But it was a tease, a preliminary. Having felt the relief of even that much speaking, I want more. And if I talk to him, I'll say something wrong, give something away. I can feel it coming, a betrayal of myself. I don't want him to know too much. Oh, I was in market research, to begin with, he says diffidently. After that, I sort of branched out. It strikes me that, although I know he's a commander, I don't know what he's a commander of. What does he control? What is his field, as they used to say? They don't have specific titles.
Oh, I say, trying to sound as if I understand.
You might say I'm a sort of scientist, he says. Within limits, of course. After that, he doesn't say anything for a while, and neither do I. We are outwaiting each other.
I'm the one to break first.
Well, maybe you could tell me something I've been wondering about. He shows interest.
What might that be?
I'm heading into danger, but I can't stop myself. It's a phrase I remember from somewhere. Best not to say where. I think it's in Latin, and I thought maybe... I know he has a Latin dictionary. He has dictionaries of several kinds, on the top shelf to the left of the fireplace.
Tell me, he says. Distanced, but more alert. Or am I imagining it?
Nolite te bastardis, carborundorum, I say.
What? He says.
I haven't pronounced it properly. I don't know how.
I could spell it, I say. Write it down.
He hesitates at this novel idea. Possibly he doesn't remember I can. I've never held a pen or a pencil in this room, not even to add up the scores.
Women can't add, he once said, jokingly.
When I asked him what he meant, he said, for them, one and one and one and one don't make four.
What do they make? I said, expecting five or three.
Just one and one and one and one, he said.
But now he says, all right, and thrusts his roller-tip pen across the desk at me, almost defiantly, as if taking a dare. I look around for something to write on, and he hands me the score pad, a desktop notepad with a little smile-button face printed at the top of the page.
They still make those things.
I print the phrase carefully, copying it down from inside my head, from inside my closet.
Nolite te bastardes, carborundorum.
Here, in this context, it's neither prayer nor command, but a sad graffiti, scrawled once, abandoned. The pen between my fingers is sensuous, alive, almost. I can feel its power, the power of the words it contains.
Pen is envy, Aunt Lydia would say, quoting another center motto, warning us away from such objects. And they were right, it is envy. Just holding it is envy. I envy the commander his pen. It's one more thing I would like to steal.
The commander takes the smile button page from me and looks at it. Then he begins to laugh.
And is he blushing?
That's not real Latin, he says. That's just a joke.
A joke? I say, bewildered now. It can't be only a joke. Have I risked this? Made a grab at knowledge for a mere joke?
What sort of a joke?
You know how schoolboys are, he says. His laughter is nostalgic, I see now, the laughter of indulgence towards his former self.
He gets up, crosses to the bookshelves, takes down a book from his trove. Not the dictionary, though. It's an old book, a textbook, it looks like, dog-eared and inky. Before showing it to me, he thumbs through it, contemplative, reminiscent. Then,
here, he says, laying it open on the desk in front of me.
What I see first is a picture. The Venus de Milo, in a black and white photo, with a mustache and a black brassiere and armpit hair drawn clumsily on her. On the opposite page is the Colosseum in Rome, labeled in English, and below, a conjugation. Sum es est, sumus estis sunt.
There, he says, pointing, and in the margin I see it, written in the same ink as the hair on the Venus. Nolite de bastardis, carborundorum.
It's sort of hard to explain why it's funny unless you know Latin, he says. We used to write all kinds of things like that. I don't know where we got them. From older boys, perhaps.
Forgetful of me and of himself, he's turning the pages.
Look at this, he says,
The picture is called The Sabine Women, and in the margin is scrawled, Pim Pis Pit, Pimis Pistis Pants. There was another one, he says. Kim Kiss Kit. He stops, returning to the present, embarrassed. Again he smiles. This time you could call it a grin. I imagine freckles on him, a cowlick. Right now I almost like him. But what did it mean, I say. Which, he says. Oh, it meant, don't let the bastards grind you down. I guess we thought we were pretty smart back then. I force a smile, but it's all before me now. I can see why she wrote that, on the wall of the cupboard. But I also see that she must have learned it here, in this room. Where else? She was never a schoolboy. With him, during some previous period of boyhood reminiscence, of confidences exchanged. I have not been the first, then. To enter his silence, play children's word games with him. What happened to her? I say. He hardly misses a beat. Did you know her somehow? Somehow, I say. She hanged herself, he says, thoughtfully, not sadly. That's why we had the light fixture removed, in your room. He pauses. Serena found out, he says, as if this explains it. And it does. If your dog dies, get another. What with? I say. He doesn't want to give me any ideas. Does it matter? He says. Torn bedsheet, I figure. I've considered the possibilities. I suppose it was Cora who found her, I say. That's why she screamed. Yes, he says. Poor girl. He means Cora. Maybe I shouldn't come here anymore, I say. I thought you were enjoying it, he says lightly, watching me, however, with intent, bright eyes. If I didn't know better, I would think it was fear. I wish you would. You want my life to be bearable to me, I say. It comes out not as a question, but as a flat statement. Flat and without dimension. If my life is bearable, maybe what they're doing is all right after all. Yes, he says. I do. I would prefer it. Well then, I say. Things have changed. I have something on him now. What I have on him is the possibility of my own death. What I have on him is his guilt. At last. What would you like? He says, still with that lightness, as if it's a money transaction merely, and a minor one at that, candy, cigarettes. Besides hand lotion, you mean, I say. Besides hand lotion, he agrees. I would like to know. It sounds indecisive, stupid even, I say it without thinking. Know what? He says. Whatever there is to know, I say. But that's too flippant. What's going on? 11. Night. Chapter 30. Night falls, or has fallen. Why is it that night falls instead of rising like the dawn? Yet if you look east at sunset, you can see night rising, not falling, darkness lifting into the sky, up from the horizon like a black sun behind cloud cover, like smoke from an unseen fire, a line of fire just below the horizon, brush fire or a burning city. Maybe night falls because it's heavy, a thick curtain pulled up over the eyes, wool blanket. I wish I could see in the dark better than I do. Night has fallen, then. I feel it pressing down on me like a stone. No breeze. I sit by the partly open window, curtains tucked back because there's no one out there. No need for modesty in my nightgown. Long-sleeved, even in summer, to keep us from the temptations of our own flesh, to keep us from hugging ourselves bare-armed. Nothing moves in the searchlight moonlight. The scent from the garden rises like heat from a body. There must be night-blooming flowers, it's so strong. I can almost see it, red radiation wavering upwards like the shimmer above highway tarmac at noon. Down there on the lawn, someone emerges from the spill of darkness under the willow, steps across the light, his long shadow attached sharply to his heels. Is it Nick? Or is it someone else? Someone of no importance? He stops, looks up at this window, and I can see the white oblong of his face. Nick. We look at each other. I have no rose to toss. He has no loot. But it's the same kind of hunger, which I can't indulge. I pull the left-hand curtain so that it falls between us, across my face, and after a moment he walks on, into the invisibility around the corner. What the commander said is true. One and one and one and one doesn't equal four. Each one remains unique. There is no way of joining them together. They cannot be exchanged, one for the other. They cannot replace each other. Nick for Luke, or Luke for Nick. Should does not apply. You can't help what you feel, Moira once said. But you can help how you behave. Which is all very well. Context is all. Or is it ripeness? One or the other. The night before we left the house that last time, I was walking through the rooms. Nothing was packed up because we weren't taking much with us and we couldn't afford even then to give the least appearance of leaving. So I was just walking through, here and there, looking at things, at the arrangement we had made together for our life. I had some idea that I would be able to remember afterwards what it had looked like. Luke was in the living room. He put his arms around me. We were both feeling miserable. How were we to know we were happy even then? Because we at least had that, arms around. The cat is what he said. Cat, I said, against the wool of his sweater. We can't just leave her here. I hadn't thought about the cat. Neither of us had. Our decision had been sudden, and then there had been the planning to do. I must have thought she was coming with us, but she couldn't. You don't take a cat on a day trip across the border. Why not outside? I said. We could just leave her. She'd hang around and mew at the door. Someone would notice we were gone. We could give her away, I said. One of the neighbors. Even as I said this, I saw how foolish that would be. I'll take care of it, Luke said. And because he said it instead of her, I knew he meant kill. That is what you have to do before you kill, I thought. You have to create an it where none was before. You do that first in your head, and then you make it real. So that's how they do it, I thought. I seemed never to have known that before. Luke found the cat, who was hiding under our bed. They always know. He went into the garage with her. I don't know what he did, and I never asked him. I sat in the living room, hands folded in my lap. I should have gone out with him, taken that small responsibility. I should at least have asked him about it afterwards, so he didn't have to carry it alone. Because that little sacrifice, that snuffing out of love, was done for my sake as well. That's one of the things they do. They force you to kill. Within yourself. Useless, as it turned out. I wonder who told them. It could have been a neighbor, watching our car pull out from the driveway in the morning, acting on a hunch, tipping them off for a gold star on someone's list. It could even have been the man who got us the passports. Why not get paid twice? Like them, even, to plant the passport forgers themselves. A net for the unwary. The eyes of God run over all the earth.
Because they were ready for us and waiting. The moment of betrayal is the worst. The moment when you know beyond any doubt that you've been betrayed, that some other human being has wished you that much evil. It was like being in an elevator cut loose at the top, falling, falling, and not knowing when you will hit. I try to conjure, to raise my own spirits from wherever they are. I need to remember what they look like. I try to hold them still behind my eyes, their faces like pictures in an album. But they won't stay still for me. They move. There's a smile and it's gone. Their features curl and bend, as if the paper's burning. Blackness eats them. A glimpse, a pale shimmer on the air, a glow, aurora, dance of electrons, then a face again, faces. But they fade. Though I stretch out my arms towards them, they slip away from me. Ghosts at daybreak. Back to wherever they are. Stay with me, I want to say. But they won't. It's my fault. I'm forgetting too much. Tonight I will say my prayers. No longer kneeling at the foot of the bed, knees on the hard wood of the gym floor, Aunt Elizabeth standing by the double doors, arms folded, cattle prod hung on her belt, while Aunt Lydia strides along the rows of kneeling, nightgowned women, hitting our backs, or feet, or bums, or arms lightly. Just a flick, a tap, with her wooden pointer, if we slouch or slacken. She wanted our heads bowed just right, our toes together and pointed, our elbows at the proper angle. Part of her interest in this was aesthetic. She liked the look of the thing. She wanted us to look like something Anglo-Saxon, carved on a tomb, or Christmas card angels, regimented in our robes of purity. But she knew, too, the spiritual value of bodily rigidity, of muscle strain. A little pain cleans out the mind, she'd say. What we prayed for was emptiness, so we would be worthy to be filled with grace, with love, with self-denial, semen and babies. Oh God, King of the universe, thank you for not creating me a man. Oh God, obliterate me. Make me fruitful. Mortify my flesh that I may be multiplied. Let me be fulfilled. Some of them would get carried away with this, the ecstasy of abasement. Some of them would moan and cry. There is no point in making a spectacle of yourself, Janine, said Aunt Lydia. I pray where I am, sitting by the window, looking out through the curtain at the empty garden. I don't even close my eyes. Out there or inside my head, it's an equal darkness or light. My God, who art in the kingdom of heaven, which is within, I wish you would tell me your name. The real one, I mean. But you will do as well as anything. I wish I knew what you were up to. But whatever it is, help me to get through it, please. Though maybe it's not your doing. I don't believe for an instant that what's going on out there is what you meant. I have enough daily bread, so I won't waste time on that. It isn't the main problem. The problem is getting it down without choking on it. Now we come to forgiveness. Don't worry about forgiving me right now. There are more important things. For instance, keep the others safe, if they are safe. Don't let them suffer too much. If they have to die, let it be fast. You might even provide a heaven for them. We need you for that. Hell we can make for ourselves. I suppose I should say I forgive whoever did this and whatever they're doing now. I'll try, but it isn't easy. Temptation comes next. At the center, temptation was anything much more than eating and sleeping. Knowing was a temptation. What you don't know won't tempt you, Aunt Lydia used to say. Maybe I don't really want to know what's going on. Maybe I'd rather not know. Maybe I couldn't bear to know. The fall was a fall from innocence to knowledge. I think about the chandelier too much, though it's gone now. But you could use a hook in the closet. I've considered the possibilities. All you'd have to do after attaching yourself would be to lean your weight forward and not fight. Deliver us from evil. Then there's kingdom, power, and glory. It takes a lot to believe in those right now, but I'll try it anyway. In hope, as they say on the gravestones. You must feel pretty ripped off. I guess it's not the first time. If I were you, I'd be fed up. I'd really be sick of it. I guess that's the difference between us. I feel very unreal talking to you like this. I feel as if I'm talking to a wall. I wish you'd answer. I feel so alone. All alone by the telephone. Except I can't use the telephone. And if I could, who could I call? Oh, God, it's no joke. Oh, God, oh, God. How can I keep on living? 12. Jezebels. Chapter 31. Every night when I go to bed, I think, in the morning I'll wake up in my own house and things will be back the way they were. It hasn't happened this morning, either. I put on my clothes, summer clothes. It's still summer. It seems to have stopped at summer. July. It's breathless days and sauna nights, hard to sleep. I make a point of keeping track. I should scratch marks on the wall, one for each day of the week, and run a line through them when I have 7. But what would be the use? This isn't a jail sentence. There's no time here that can be done and finished with. Anyway, all I have to do is ask to find out what day it is. Yesterday was July the 4th, which used to be Independence Day before they abolished it. September 1st will be Labor Day. They still have that, though it didn't used to have anything to do with mothers. But I tell time by the moon. Lunar, not solar. I bend over to do up my red shoes, lighter weight these days, with discreet slits cut in them, though nothing so daring as sandals. It's an effort to stoop, despite the exercises. I can feel my body gradually seizing up, refusing. Being a woman this way is how I used to imagine it would be to be very old. I feel I even walk like that, crouched over, my spine constricting to a question mark, my bones leached of calcium and porous as limestone. When I was younger, imagining age, I would think, maybe you appreciate things more when you don't have much time left. I forgot to include the loss of energy. Some days I do appreciate things more. Eggs, flowers. But then I decide I'm only having an attack of sentimentality. My brain going pastel technicolor, like the beautiful sunset greeting cards they used to make so many of in California. High gloss hearts. The danger is gray out. I'd like to have Luke here, in this bedroom while I'm getting dressed, so I could have a fight with him. Absurd, but that's what I want. An argument about who should put the dishes in the dishwasher, whose turn it is to sort the laundry, clean the toilet, something daily and unimportant in the big scheme of things. We could even have a fight about that, about unimportant, important. What a luxury it would be. Not that we did it much. These days I script whole fights in my head, and the reconciliations afterwards, too. I sit in my chair, the wreath on the ceiling floating above my head like a frozen halo, a zero, a hole in space where a star exploded, a ring on water where a stone's been thrown. All things white and circular. I wait for the day to unroll, for the earth to turn according to the round face of the implacable clock, the geometrical days which go around and around, smoothly and oiled.
Sweat already on my upper lip, I wait for the arrival of the inevitable egg, which will be lukewarm like the room.